We're looking tonight at what it means to stay healthy when you're under stress. If you look on the internet, there is pretty much an infinite amount of advice out there. Make sure you eat properly with enough of the food groups. Get yourself some exercise and sunlight each day. See enough friends. Don't cut yourself off from people. Sleep as well as you can. Don't look at screens before you go to bed, etc., etc., etc. But tonight, we're not really thinking about staying healthy individually, or staying healthy physically, or even mentally. But really, we're thinking about how to stay healthy corporately, that is, as a group, and spiritually. In other words, what would it mean for us as a church to remain healthy under times of stress as a church that we come under? What would it mean for us to remain united, gospel-focused, faithful to God under pressure? For make no mistake, there are times and places when churches come under particular causes of strain. And I look back at my Christian life, I think for about 10 years, I just didn't think about church at all. All I thought about was kind of my going to church. What time? Is it 7 o'clock, 7:30? You know, I couldn't remember. Where is it? Does it meet here or there? And when you first become a Christian, sometimes it's all you can do just to sort of get yourself to church. And that's the main thing if ever you're going to grow as a Christian and come under his word and meet with God's people. But there comes a time when the health of the church actually becomes important to us. We realize it's not just about me, but about us, about God's expression, God's people in this place. So what would it take for us as a congregation at 7 o'clock, to stand strong when there are certain pressures upon us, or us as a church at St. John's to stand strong in that way? Well, 1 Peter is a letter that's going to help us. It's written to churches to help them remain healthy and strong so that they might stand firm in the true grace of God, chapter 5, verse 12. And no matter what kinds of challenges we may face as a church in years to come, whether they're challenges that come from outside of the church, external pressures, as was largely the case Peter was talking about, persecution and the like, or whether they're internal problems and pressures that can easily come for a variety of reasons within church life, the same question comes to us. What will it take to make us as a congregation, us as a church, strong and able to endure, to stand firm in that true grace of God? And that's really what we're looking at tonight. It's very simple, the passage, and there are two main things that Peter has to say. The first is godly leadership. You'll find a simple outline on the inside of the program there if you want to take notes or just to help you follow along. Godly leadership. That is, Peter has had a lot to say in terms of the various responsibilities we have as Christians. He's talked about how we're to submit to authorities. He's talked about how husbands and wives are to treat each other. Talked about how to deal with sin, how to react the right way to suffering. And now he turns to leaders within the church. Have a look at chapter 5, verse 1. To the elders among you, I appeal, he says, as a fellow elder, a witness of Christ's sufferings, and one who also will share in the glory to be revealed. In any organization, the leaders have an important role to play. And that's as true within a church as it is any other organization that we might come across in life. In passing, let me just say a word about the structure we have at St. John's. You might say we have three formal types of leaders within St. John's. There's the vestry, which is the official leadership body elected each year to stand for 1 year. It's vestry's responsibility to set the direction of the church. And from this congregation, Rachel Aspinall and Brad Mitchell sit on the vestry. Then there's the staff, and the paid staff at church, you might say, execute the direction set by the vestry. And then there are those appointed to be small group leaders who have primary responsibility for pastoral care and for teaching in small groups. And if Peter was writing to us as a church at St. John's, I would imagine he would speak to all three groups. But when you think about it, what he's going to say is going to apply a lot wider than that. Because anyone who's in a position of responsibility will need to learn, will need to overhear what he's saying here. If you're a youth group leader, or you teach in Sunday school, or in some other way, you need to learn what he says here. And insofar as leaders in the church are to model characteristics, what he says here will actually apply to everyone who wants to serve in any way in church life. Now, you notice there in verse 1, that Peter doesn't lean on them as the great apostle. He doesn't appeal to his own apostlehood, as he could have done, but he says, I appeal to you as a fellow elder. So he's not high and mighty, he's empathetic to the pressures to those who come upon those who are in leadership. Then he speaks as one who is a witness of Christ's sufferings. So this isn't going to be advice dispensed from the luxury of an ivory tower. He is speaking as someone who saw what Christ went through, and therefore he knows what Christians are likely to go through. He's sympathetic to them in the difficulties they're likely to face. And he reminds them of their common inheritance, verse 1, as one who also will share in the glory to be revealed. He's reminding them that through the difficulties, you have to keep your eye fixed ahead, that there is a brighter day ahead when we're there with Christ in the heavenly places, seeing his glory on the day that it's revealed. And although some dark and murky times we have to pass through on earth that God in his wisdom brings to us, nonetheless, there is ahead a brighter day, which Peter reminds them is coming. Then he gives them the big command, verse 2. Have a look down. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, serving as overseers. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care. Peter likens, employing a familiar biblical metaphor, likens the people of God to a flock of sheep. That is, naturally, we are vulnerable and we are prone to wander. We're at risk of being gobbled up, and shepherds are the people who've been appointed to protect God's people and to feed them. Shepherds to us might, if you think about what a shepherd's job involves, it might sort of seem slightly sort of idyllic, particularly on an afternoon like we've just had today. Imagine a shepherd sort of wandering around the Canterbury hillside. But back in the first century, they were really the bodyguards of the day. Good shepherds were tough, they were committed, and if they're going to look after the sheep who are under their care, they had to be prepared to put their own bodies on the line. And significantly, Peter wants these leaders in the church to succeed where previous leaders of God's people have failed. Because in the Old Testament, God also appointed leaders of his people and called them shepherds then as well. They were to do two things mainly, which was to provide for the people of God and to protect the people of God. Provide as in feed them, the word of God, and protect them from false teachers around. But instead, the leaders back in the Old Testament, they turned from God. They began to seek personal acclamation. They became corrupt. They became allowed themselves to be in the pockets of wealthy people so that they only spoke what wealthy people wanted to hear. They were bought off, in other words. We're told that they didn't listen to the word of the Lord themselves, and because they didn't listen, they were unable to teach the word of the Lord. They just spoke what came out of their own mouths, out of their own heads, which was total rubbish. Peace, peace, everything's fine, they said, even though the Lord had said he was going to bring judgment on his people. So they sold the people short. They failed to warn them of the judgment to come. And eventually the hammer fell, not just on the people of God, but on the leaders that God had entrusted to look after his people. Ezekiel 34, God actually prophesies against these very leaders, that they would now be removed from office. And then God made a wonderful promise in that chapter. He says that there will come a day when I will come to lead my people. I will come to fulfill the role that these shepherds have so badly not fulfilled. And so the people wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. When will God come in this way? And eventually Jesus of Nazareth steps forward and says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And so, verse 4, he is the chief shepherd. The chief shepherd who died once for all for his people and one day will return in glory. And now, in that in-between time, between his first and second comings, he is appointing people in churches to be his, you might say, under-shepherds, to shepherd the flock under the control of the great shepherd. And these under-shepherds, they're to protect the flock from false teaching, and they're to provide for the people of God to feed them through teaching the word of God. Now, how are they to go about doing this? and you get these three commands here, three ways. First of all, verse 2, not because you must, but because you are willing. So if you have a job to do in church life, whatever it is, and particularly if you're in a position of leadership, don't do it just because you feel you have to, or just as a duty. Don't do it just because it doesn't feel as if there's anyone else to do it. Oh, you know, a child can't find anyone. Oh, I suppose I better carry on. You know, that sort of thing. Don't do it just because someone else has asked you to do it, as if you've got a gun to your head. Don't do it just to help someone out in that way and you don't want to let them down. Do it because you are willing. In other words, do it because you want to do it. You actually think it's worth doing and you are motivated from your heart to do it. I don't think that always means in every situation I'm absolutely, you know, desperate to get here at 4:30 and set out the chairs. You know, I just, even when it's sort of, it's not my turn to do it, I just can't, you know, it's a temptation. Some of those temptations you just can't resist. And I just can't resist arriving at 4:30 on a Sunday afternoon to help set out the chairs. It's not that kind of thing. But nonetheless, it's the kind of thing that we're willing to do. Our hearts point us in the direction of doing. And even if sometimes we have to pray for ourselves, Lord, please give me a more willing spirit. Nonetheless, we do the job because we want to do it, not because we're being forced to do it in that way. And it's lovely when people show that willing attitude, as I have to say, a lot of people in St. John's do. It kind of radiates out to other people. You know, the person that serves with a willing spirit, they always go the extra mile. And just this morning, there was someone on setup, and you're supposed to have two people in the morning, two or three, and the others didn't turn up. It was just him. But he wasn't kind of, you know, well, typical, you know, grumpy, whatever. Well, I'll just do 50% then. He was pleased to be able to help and be able to cover for someone else. A person who's doing a job begrudgingly will always be the first to complain when others are letting them down or not reaching their own high standards. But a willing spirit, no problem to go the extra mile. And I wonder if that's how you go about your service in church life. Then secondly, verse 2, not greedy for money, but eager to serve. For those who are currently doing MTS, that is ministry trainees at St. John's, it might come as something of a surprise that people in ministry could be thinking of doing ministry because of the amount of money you could get for doing it. But nonetheless, it has always been a temptation for those in positions of leadership in the church in some way to benefit from their work, sometimes to modify their message to keep others on board within church life. If you just look through the New Testament, you see that the Pharisees, we're told, they loved money. You remember how Judas sold his Lord for 30 pieces of silver. Today, you might say that modern accounting methods make dodgy dealings a little bit harder, but sometimes there is access to money, cash, in church life. A couple of times in my ministry, people have, part of my ministry is seeing people towards the end of their life, and a couple of times, including once last year, people have volunteered they would like to change their will, as I have been there by their deathbed. And you can imagine that one is beginning to skate on rather thin ice if you accept that sort of offer, even if they're changing their will to give money to the church. It's the thought that you might have influenced them in that way, and the wise person will have nothing to do with that kind of a conversation. Sometimes there can be an unwillingness to take difficult decisions in church life, which could mean that a wealthier family is likely to leave the church. It's much easier to soften things to enable them to stay in that way. And at a very base level, we shouldn't be greedy doing ministry, greedy for anything that we can get out of it. Not for self-fulfillment, not for self-satisfaction, not for admiration, not for comments of praise. We should simply be doing it eagerly, that is, eagerly to serve. That is, the job itself is sufficiently worthwhile that we're just pleased to do it because it needs to be done. And it's a privilege to be able to help in that way. And then the third way, verse 3, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. In every other sphere of life, wherever there is a hierarchy, the higher you go, the more status is accredited to you, and the more people will do to do things for you. It's true in business, it's true in the hospital, it's true in the army, it's true in any human organization. It has that kind of pyramid structure. And the higher you go up the top, the more people you have underneath who are happy, willing, for whatever motive, to do things to please you, in theory at least, except in the church. Yes, there are people in the church, in the local church, with positions of responsibility, but when in one of those positions of responsibility, don't you be the person who then lords it over other people. The rest of the people are not there at our beck and call, expecting we're not to be those who expect others to do the hard work while we just marshal the troops. Rather, he says, be an example to the flock. An example, for example, of hard work. Be someone who doesn't just kind of, you know, stand back and barks a few orders as you see things that need to be done, but be the person that actually gets stuck in. Give an example of hard work. And I can tell you that every person on the vestry and every person on the staff are hard workers. Many of those who serve on the vestry in church life are serving in other ways as well, often helping with menial jobs. And I remember soon after I became a Christian, seeing church leaders do lowly jobs was something that struck me right from the off. I hadn't been a Christian very long, just a few months, and someone asked me, could I come and help on a kids' holiday camp during the summer months, the equivalent of a snow venture. And I was there as a task forcer to do the washing up. That was fine. That was why I was there. But it was striking to me that some of the leaders would wander into the kitchen. And they wouldn't just sort of, you know, wander through, you know, pick up a tea towel at one end of the kitchen and sort of dust off a couple of bowls and then put it down at the other end of the kitchen and wander out again. But they were actually there and getting stuck in. And of the particularly gruesome task at hand was the task of washing the porridge pots. And when I say porridge pots, don't think, you know, domestic porridge pots. We're thinking big metal tubs with porridge that's got sort of encrusted onto the side. Anyone else? That sort of job. And I couldn't but help notice one person who I didn't know very well at the time, but was a church leader of a large church. And he was there hour after hour scrubbing these wretched things down. And when I made a comment to him, he laughed it off and he said, well, Costa, there you go. Once a task forcer, always a task forcer. You never graduate beyond that. Good little lesson. Now, these are the sort of leaders we want. If you're in leadership at St. John's, is this you? For all of us, are these qualities that we're showing? Hard work. And occasionally, when we do put in hard work, we might question whether it's worth it. And that's where verse 4 kicks in. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. When people are doing a job that is difficult, as leadership sometimes is, can be difficult in church life, there can be pressures, there can be different opinions, sometimes it's not easy to know the way forward, sometimes there is conflict within church life, sometimes there's pressures from outside, and we might think, oh, this is taking a lot of time, and this is difficult, I wish someone else was in this position. And we just have to remember verse 4, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. There's a wonderful day coming when rewards will come to those who have served the king, who have served the chief shepherd. He will be pleased to give them to you. And insofar as we have each done a job faithfully, whatever that job is in church life, the chief shepherd will be pleased to give you the reward for the work that you have done. So godly leadership is the first part of how to stay healthy as a church that is strong and united and focused on the gospel and dependent on God. Godly leadership. But then he broadens it out. And I think these are interesting verses in verses 5 to 7 in the way that they follow on. Because now Peter addresses all people in church. We all have a role to play in keeping a church strong. It's not just one person at the top or a few people, or just some people who are particularly committed. He's speaking in verses 5 to 7 to all people, and he talks about humility. What is needed to keep a church strong is humble people. It's easy, of course, to joke about humility, a bit like the person who wrote a book entitled Humility and How I Achieved It. But as a quality alongside love, which he's already spoken about in chapter 1, humility does more than anything else to keep a church together. Humility is not the thinking little of ourselves. Rather, it's the not thinking of ourselves at all. It's the thinking what is best for us as a church, what's best for other people, what's best for him, what's best for her, how can I help in any and every situation. Humility always has that focus on other people. And where humility is concerned, there's no ego to be bruised because there's no ego in play. Humility is looking past ourselves just to others in that way. And to that extent, humility can only really come when we're secure of our status from God himself given in Christ. And in the letter of 1 Peter, Peter's had an awful lot to say about how we've been chosen by God, how we're secure in Christ, how we are heirs looking forward to an inheritance. It's only when you have that security that you don't need to feel threatened, but rather you're liberated in order to serve others. So Peter turns to one group in particular. Verse 5, young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older. In the same way as others earlier in the letter have been asked to be submissive. Why the young men? I think it's because young men often have the energy, the strong-mindedness, sometimes the clarity of what ought to happen in a situation. But if those qualities are unrestrained, then positive qualities can turn into just being headstrong, can lead young men into fractious disputes, especially when others see things differently. Young men can quickly enter into arguments over details, unwise arguments. When they come up against other young men, you end up sort of with, kind of stags rutting against each other. When the subject in hand is sort of comparatively minor, but you can look on from a distance thinking, goodness, these people are really at it with one another in that kind of way. Often, I suppose you'd say, it's the danger of expressing opinions about things which are, well, really, the Bible doesn't even give an opinion. It's that sort of thing. And we find ourselves drawn into making sort of silly, outrageous statements on things. What was it we had the other week? Cafe church, And afterwards, absolutely terrible, awful. I mean, how can you expect the church to grow if we put on that kind of thing? Sort of outrageous. Or, as I remember at one time in the past, when I suggested people turn around and pray with the person next to them. I can't, if we do that again, I'm not even coming back to the church, said one person. Not from this congregation, I will say. But it's that kind of overstrength of an opinion, when the Bible doesn't even give an opinion on the subject. And sometimes comparatively young men are appointed pastors, and the problems can quickly arise for precisely this reason. They want everything to be done their way. They take things far too personally when someone expresses disagreement, and you see how quickly disharmony can seep into church life. So to preserve order, Peter says young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older. That means that even if your opinion is better than the older person's, as it probably is, you just have the humility to sit back and take it on the chin this time and do what other people say. And then with the benefit of hindsight, you can say to yourself, actually, I think I was right after all. It would have been better. Or you say, actually, no, maybe there were things to learn along the way. It's not really to do with who has the best opinion. It's to do with having the humility that causes me to listen to others and to submit to other ways of doing things in that way. But it's not only young men who need to have the humility to live with the preferences of others. Because you see there in the second half of verse 5, he broadens it out further. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So if you want the grace of God in your own life, and in the life of your church, says Peter, then be humble. Because otherwise, you'll actually find that the living God opposes you. And we'll begin to find it very difficult as Christians individually and or as a church if by our pride we force God to oppose us. It's much easier working with God than it is against him. We're to humble ourselves before God and then he will lift us up. Verse 6. If you humble yourselves under God's mighty hand, he will lift you up in due time. If we humble ourselves as a church and dependent on him, if we humble ourselves as individuals within church life dependent on him, in the way that we treat other people, in time God will help us to become the church that he would love us to be, a church full of Christ-like people that is a delight to be part of, that is welcoming to others, that is friendly, that is united, that's gracious, where the relationships are encouraging when you're down, and for a whole host of other reasons, is just a pleasure to be a part of. Now, what does this humility towards others look like? Because you see, it's both humility under God's hand, but it's also humility, verse 5, towards one another. What does that look like? I just want to give you 6 quick suggestions. First of all, it means actively offering to serve. There is something humble about a person saying, wherever you need me, whatever you need me to do, I'm willing to do it. Often it's the arrogant person who assumes they are busier than everyone else. I'll say, you know, I would have liked to help, I'm really busy. As if other people weren't, you know? But it's the humble people who's, well, I'm busy, yeah, but so are they. And whatever you need doing, I'm happy to do it. Actively offering to serve. And you will see on the outline slip, as coincidence would have it, that there is a box. I would like to help serve at St. John's. So if you feel you're underused, there you go. Secondly, humility can be seen when we replace fault-finding with appreciation. Nearly always in life, you can think of ways that things could have been done better or quicker or more efficiently or to a higher standard or whatever. It's easy to pick holes. But there's also an arrogance that comes with that, as if I always know what is best in that way, or it ignores all the effort that other people put in to get the job done in the first place. And at the end of the day, it's not our job to offer a running commentary on how everyone else goes about their business in church life as anywhere else. But appreciation, on the other hand, that is what I can do. It's a marvellous thing when someone is grateful and expresses that. And a lot of people at St. John's are very grateful, and it's a sign of humility. Thirdly, a way of humility towards each other, supporting others when you think differently. Often there are 1,000 ways to skin a cat, and there are many ways of going about things or making decisions, often in areas that the Bible doesn't pronounce. And it's humble to support those, even when we had a different way of doing it. I learned that at the same kids' camps I was referring to earlier, when he didn't say this, someone else said this, that the leader of the camps, Ian, we were told as young leaders joining the team, that if Ian makes a decision and 99 of us think the other way, then we all support Ian. And it was a good way of putting it. You support those even when you think differently. Fourthly, refusing to take offence. Humility can be seen when someone decides they're not going to take offence at someone else's silliness. I'm not talking about major incidents or things that need to be sort of properly dealt with in church life, but just the little flare-ups, the off-putting manner, the careless words, the thoughtless action. And if we're not careful, a bit of a history can build up, you know? Oh, yeah, I remember. And I'm actually blessed to be married to someone, Teresa, who has a wonderful absence of memory when it comes to these kind of things. Next day, she can't remember things that I did the previous day or said the previous day or whatever, which is just a great gift to have. I, on the other hand, am an expert in remembering all the wrong things in life. And so message to myself, don't hang on to the history and don't take offence. I was saying this morning in church life, thinking of Mother's Day, my mother is someone who is just a great example of this. I think she is resolved in life not to take offence at other people. If someone in church life does something that's a bit silly or says something silly or, you know, offends her in some way, she will just leave it with them. And she said, you know, they're probably under pressure. They probably weren't thinking, whatever it was. But she won't take offence at it. And there's something humble there because the ego isn't involved. Fifthly, humility is seen in the way that we can have time for, quote-unquote, lesser people. Having time for people who are different to ourselves, who are poorer or not as trendy or not as sociable or who don't fit in quite as well to a group, people who others don't want to speak to, helping those kind of people, speaking with those kind of people, mixing with those kind of people, including those kind of people, is a sign of humility. Girls who are looking for a romantic partner can often, like the man who is confident or who is tall, dark and handsome. But actually, the kind of man they ought to want is the person who will talk to the kind of person that no one else talks to. The kind of man they ought to want is the kind of man who will love other people that no one else will love. Because if he will love those sort of people, then he's bound to love her as well. Otherwise, you end up in a rat race where she's always having to compete for his attention with all the other people that also want to talk to him in that way. If you get what I mean, so humility is giving to those who can't return the favour. It's showing hospitality to those who can't be hospitable back to us. But the sixth example of humility is actually the biblical one. Verse 7, that is praying to God. Cast all your anxiety on God because he cares for you. We should pray about every situation, but especially situations in church life that are causing tension or difficulty or pressure in some way. And when those situations come up, our focus tends to be on those, on what someone said or what someone's done or the situation we're in. What we need to do is talk to God instead. And if we find ourselves talking to others about others rather than talking to God about others, then we've got it the wrong way around. Notice that he says not just cast your anxiety, but cast all your anxiety on him. So let me ask you, are you annoyed with someone? Are you frustrated with someone? Next question, have you talked to God about that situation and about that person before then, secondly, speaking to them rather than other people? Cast all your anxiety on him. So this is what is needed, and it boils down to humility. What a wonderfully generous, welcoming, friendly, forgiving, pleasant, united, strong sort of church it would be when these two qualities are displayed: godly leadership and humble people.